Nobody wants to be brave enough to try it?
Not me.
A word or phrase that describes something in memory. I know what it is, but I can't.
Okay, that's a good start. What's the difference between an analogy and a metaphor?
One is and one is like.
Okay, one is and one is like. Now these are words that we use all the time, but now suddenly we have to start saying, what's the difference between is and like? Boy, my mind is going blank. Well, of course it's going blank, because you never had to think for yourself. Now we're going to think for ourselves and figure it out. I use a metaphor to describe a metaphor. The way I look at it is a metaphor is it's not a sign or a symbol or an image. It's usually a process or a story or a phrase. And what it does is it shows us the truth without having to look directly at the truth. It is almost like instead of looking at the sun, you look at the shadow that it casts on the ground. What you're doing is you're describing the light as it plays on the earth in order to understand what the sun is and how it operates. That is a metaphor. It is a small microcosmic manifestation of the larger truth. When you think of a metaphor, you're thinking of a small example of something that leads you to the greater truth. Yes?
What is truth?
Truth is a subjective thing, but that was sort of my metaphor for it. If I want to take it out of the context of truth, I would say it's a small microcosmic example of a greater whole.
Okay.
So we're looking at the greater whole. And understanding it better by seeing this small part of it. It's almost like gene engineering, where a small little bit of biological material can actually create an entire organism. So that piece of genetic material is a metaphor for the organism. It is not the organism, but in that is all the information that the organism has or is. An analogy is saying this whole idea is sort of like this whole idea. In other words, what it's doing is comparing two apples and two oranges. They are both two. So we're not talking about a small part of a greater thing. We're talking about things that are roughly equal. Analogies are roughly equal. Metaphors are microcosmic examples of a greater truth or being. Have we all got that so far? Anyone lost?
Yeah, Lori, I think we've talked about four terms, symbol and sign and metaphor and analogy. We might want to just give some examples of each one or review that again, because taking notes and thinking at the same time is a little difficult.
Okay, who wants to give me an example of a symbol? Let's try not to use the Star of David and a cross. I think you can come up with another symbol. Yeah. Go ahead.
The Nazi sign.
Okay.
Swastika.
Perfect example. Why is that a symbol?
It shows back in history what happened in Germany and what it relates to now, the German army force. It also has, in the Hindu religion, it's a religious symbol.
Very good. It is also a fertility sign. Yes. Very good. Okay.
Yeah. Are all symbols then, they don't have to be like something you can write on paper. Can they be like a picture or an action or?
Sure, you can have symbolic actions. I mean, you're talking about Nazi Germany. The particular kind of salute is a very symbolic gesture. You can have symbolic gestures. There are many images that have great and powerful symbologies, and I have a collection of images to show you to help that.
Be like music, like the da-da-da-da. Is that a symbol?
That's a musical gesture. I don't know that you can say exactly what the connotation is, but for most people it goes beyond the obvious and superficial. But it's interpreted in many different ways by different people, whereas normally a symbol is interpreted similarly in one culture. So there's an agreement. So if we're all Western music, da-da-da-da means something, but if we're in Africa, then no.
Kathleen, before I get to you, the thing about that is like, that's a sign for me. Oh, Beethoven. That's as far as it goes for me. So that's like a sign. Now, if you are a person who is mystically into Beethoven, it may have symbolic reference for you personally. but not in the kind of greater.
The minor third means da di da da and is interpreted as da di da da because it's the opening for it. I could, you know, spend a while talking about it, but it's not. But they do have a lot of symbols in music, especially at the beginning.
Christine, I think, had a hand.
These symbols are all really broad. Do they have to mean something to more than one person?
Good point. Symbol is a way of communicating a great deal of language, usually kind of mysterious, to a wider group of people. You can have a personal symbol that may represent, say, your childhood or your feelings about a particular thing. And it is a symbol to you, but as a communication tool, it is worthless. Oftentimes, however, some one person will develop an image that has connotations or meanings that are shared by a group of friends or a wider group of family or community, and that symbol then can become increasingly, the symbol becomes a greater symbol through usage. So if more people start using it and identifying it and seeming to communicate through it and share a kind of communal mystery about it, then it becomes a greater symbol.
So for shrines, would we want symbols that are going to mean something to everyone else?
Yeah, we'll talk about that in a little bit, but yeah, we're going to want to communicate.
Some consensus.
Luckily, we all come from roughly the same culture with some differences here, which gives us an advantage. I mean, just think if we had people from Africa and Latin America and Inuit and a couple of Native Americans in here, we'd have a lot of trouble communicating with our own personal symbologies. Todd, you had a point.
Exactly the same service in two, that symbols can be all relative to the person.
Like, yes, they can be. But the thing that makes a symbol powerful is the fact that it is a shared commonality. And that's what I want us to try and struggle with coming up with, something that is personal and can also be shared or communicated. It's not easy, and I don't expect you to have much luck at it the first time around. So just understand that, accept that. Okay, so we all understand sign or symbol, and I think we probably all understand sign out of that other one. Now the other guys were metaphor. Did we all understand metaphor? Someone want to give me an example of a metaphor? It's tough, especially when it put you on the spot. Suddenly your minds go blank. I must not have had enough coffee today. I don't know.
Is that what we were doing last night, when we were saying holding is, POU is, weren't those just all metaphors?
That's
a symbol. Someone used is like, or as. Yeah, I think
that is more like an analogy.
Yeah, I think you're right. We're getting now more terms that I don't want to get too involved with a lot of definitions. But you're right, that was a little too narrow to make it into a metaphor. You'll see, I use the word metaphor all the time. To me, this class is an incredibly powerful metaphor. And what I like to do is think that your lives and your behavior become powerful metaphors for you. What that means then is you look at what you understand about your lives, or you begin to watch your behavior, and you take that kind of microcosmic bit of information, and you use that as a way of projecting on to this greater awareness. And you can understand that greater awareness by watching its smaller manifestation. If it means the way you relate to your girlfriend or boyfriend, then maybe that has something to do with the rest of that. That's a rather vague example of a metaphor.
Well, you could almost say, if you said the whole world was a metaphor, the population of humanity, we are a minuscule part of that, and we're one part of the whole. Are you more looking for just a small part of a whole for a metaphor? I don't know, it doesn't seem like that fits, because every time I hear a metaphor at school and stuff like that, it doesn't really fit with the definition you've given us.
The kind of definition that I have for metaphor, it's very similar to symbol in the sense that it implies something that is not there. The difference between a symbol and a metaphor to me is the symbol is something very small, usually visual or a word or two or an image. That implies a lot of things. A metaphor is a process of doing that. It's a kind of larger piece of the pie. But I think the important part of the metaphor to me is that it's the whole that we're talking about by talking about a small piece. We're not talking about all the small pieces. We're using a small piece to extrapolate the whole.
Laurie, could you give your example of the car? I really think that's appropriate for symbol and metaphor and clarifying that.
Okay, I have a whole series of slides I'm going to show you about using the car as metaphor. And what I do is I show you the evolution of style of the automobile. And the automobile as a symbol to American culture. But watching the progression of what happens to the automobile in terms of style and using that progression as a metaphor for the evolution of consciousness, how we think and how we feel, and this historical kind of way of doing it. I'll do that with costume as well. Look at how people dressed way back from, several thousand years ago to pretty much contemporary, assuming my wife brings the rest of the slides. In which case, what we'll do is we'll see how that is a metaphor for the evolution of consciousness. Is that any clearer then? It's a metaphor because we're not talking about consciousness, we're talking about costume. But by watching how the costumes change, or watching how the styles of cars change, we can then get a better feeling for how all of us have evolved or changed over the course of the last 50 years, or a couple hundred years with the car, and several millennia, as it has to do with costumes. Most of this will come clearer to you as you work with it. So as long as you got a basic handle on it, don't worry about it if it kind of slips away from you. Like any other concept, it only becomes clear through usage, and we'll be using it a lot. Does that help? Kate, does that seem clear enough? Okay. I think I have plenty of time here to go through some of these slides here.
Let's see if we can get our screen down.
Yeah, just pull it.
The chairs may be in the way, so you may have to move once
you turn. You may want to move away from where the... pretend this is a killer beam.
Tom, perhaps.
The lights are over there in the corner.
There are two of them.
I think...
There's lights over
here, too.
No.
We're
on the side, yeah.
Well, I think we got them over here. We got them.
Some of them.
That's okay, we can see these slides well enough. It'd be better if they weren't here. Okay. This particular stone symbol comes from about 20,000 years ago. Remember, we were talking about the idea of a fertility symbols, and obviously this is sort of what this is. Now, by today's standards, you look at it and you sort of think, well, not only is it a little crude, maybe it's a little bit rude as well, but that's sort of projecting our own cultural perspective on it. Let's try and look at it more than just a picture of a female form, but as a way of trying to communicate to their own folks what they were talking about. What aspects of this particular form are accentuated? Well, obviously the breasts and the abdomen. What is it talking about? It's talking about procreation. Procreation to them didn't mean just having a kid, buying a house, and doing all the rest of those things. Procreation meant survival. Not survival as an individual, but survival as a people. Survival as a tribe. Survival as living through. That's something most of us don't think about now. When we think about survival, basically what that means is getting a good job and being sure that you don't, that you can take care of yourself. Back then it meant something very different. Now I don't know enough about the specific symbology of, for instance, the ram's horn, which is what I assume that is over there in her hand, but it's not important. When we see this symbol, when we see that whole form encapsulated in that, is all the meaning, all the rituals that were attached to it, all the kind of context of their own spiritual belief system in their connection with each other. Here's another couple of examples from a millennia or two later. These things are not just that these guys didn't know how to do art very well. They weren't trying to represent something as it exists in reality. They're trying to represent a symbolic whole. They're trying to tell you not what a woman looks like, they're telling you what fertility looks like. They're telling you what survival looks like. They're telling you what their entire religion looks like. I sort of moved up to Egypt. I'm really going to be taking you all around here. Does this remind you of the Washington Monument? Certainly reminds me of the Washington Monument. Now, remember I talked about the number one, the image of the sort of male power, the moving up toward the sun. A lot of times people call them phallic symbols, and that sort of annoys me because anything that's longer than it is wide becomes a phallic symbol if that's the way you want to look at it. But basically what it is about is reaching up toward the sun. The idea of the sun and the earth need to come together to be able to make things happen. So maleness could not exist without femaleness. Male power means nothing without it. Female power, and this is just the other aspect of it. Now what happens as we go through this is we begin to realize, let's go back if I can. Whoops, that's supposed to be reversed. Okay, what do you see at the very top of this this pillar? Okay, if you look very closely, you follow that point down, you'll see a place where it is almost like an elongated pyramid stacked up on a column. Now that pyramid, when it was originally built, was covered with gold. It was covered with gold because when the rising sun would come over the hills of the Nile, the first thing that it would hit would be the top of that column. It would reflect the sun. It would be another indication of that energy, that powerful force coming back to the earth. Now that gold is long gone, of course, as most of the valuable things of that have gone. But what happened then is that we no longer needed that same kind of pillar force in order to be able to find that same message. As we start going down, I've just skipped another 1,000 years in Egyptian history, and we notice that now this one building almost looks like just the top part of it, except the very pinnacle of this piece actually was removed, and in later centuries they put a roof on the top of it, which is why it is truncated. But the Great Pyramid at Giza is just the top of that great pillar. What happens then is that the great thrust to get up to the sun has become another kind of metaphor, another symbol. It was just sort of taken the very part of it that was important and brought it down to earth, just made it larger and larger. Once again, there was that wonderful triangular shape. I'm jumping off here. This is a Minoan culture in Crete, and this is the earth goddess. Okay, let's see if these particular goddesses communicate something to us. Just by looking at it without knowing anything about the culture. What does it tell you? Anybody want to try? What is the most prominent part of this particular figure? Mm-hmm. Yes, somebody hesitantly said that, to the breast. Okay, there you go. What does that mean? It means a woman probably is a bearer of children. So large breasts of wide hips, what that's probably talking about is the idea of fertility. This is an earth goddess. This is a symbol of earth. It is not a symbol of sexuality. It is not a symbol of woman. It's a symbol of the earth. Woman becomes the way we look at the earth because of the kind of function that happens there. But that's what that's all about. The serpents have another issue as well as the hawk or eagle that's on her head. And we'll talk about that hawk part in just a little while. These are visual symbols. This is the great Ishtar gate. This is the Sumerian culture. And this is the gate that goes into the city. You will notice that this particular gate has all these animals all over it. Now, this is another symbol. Gates and doorways are very important symbols to a lot of our cultural predecessors because they were a metaphor. What were they a metaphor of? Well, what happens in a gate? What does a gate do? Well, you go in and you go out. The gate is the way into a world. It is the way to get out of the world. It is also a way that you can keep some people out because you can close the gate. So when you think about that as a metaphor, what does in and out mean? Well, you could kind of go off on great philosophical tangents using that as a metaphor. Well, what they did then, since that, I think that if you could speak the language and you could find their word for metaphor, and you ask them, what did the gate mean? They'd probably go, duh, I don't know what you're talking about. Because it was so ingrained in their understanding and their culture, they didn't have to talk about it. These particular animals are not there because, gee, they liked animals and they thought they'd decorate their wall with them. Those animals are there because of their mystical and powerful implications. They are guardian animals. One of the things that's real important about the cultures we came from, and in fact is still in our own attitude toward animals and beasts, is that they are sort of an unconscious connection between us and the earth. We are obviously different than most animals, but somehow there's a part of us that feels very animal-like. You all know people who feel like they were a cat in a previous life or have a particular association to horses. I know a lot of people just love horses. They almost feel like they even describe themselves as a horse person. It's not exactly like a lot of Native American cultures where you'll see a man or a woman with a horse head or a god which is part man and part animal. But it's that same kind of idea. Those are symbols. They're symbols for a greater understanding. They're not just the kind of thing that they thought looked pretty, and so they made a lot of statues about it. This is a close-up of one of those mythical guardian animals. In fact, it's the predecessor for our understanding of the unicorn. But you see a kind of combination lion, serpent, and I guess rhinoceros. But this is a guardian animal. And not only was this a symbol of guardianship, but they felt that their city was safer because this symbol existed on the wall. It actually, in fact, guarded them. Here is one of those symbols that I was talking about, a kind of deer man.
Laurie, is this American Indian?
Yes, it is.
It is.
Now there's the deer, in fact, it's really sort of interesting, and I don't want to go off on too many tangents here, I'm trying to limit the information I give you, but the deer is something, and the deer hunt is something that is a symbolic rite of fertility that exists in cultures that have absolutely nothing to do with each other. Anyone who goes about reading the Mists of Babylon will see how important it was to the Anglo-Saxon culture. It was also real important to Northern European culture in general, and was obviously an important one to American Indians. The whole idea of deer, the deer hunt, the combination spirit that was both human and animal was an important part of the cycle and attachment to the earth. And if you look at these symbols at some point when you can, and just sort of, don't worry about all the information I'm giving you, but just sort of look at them and see if you can feel something from them without having to filter it through your mind, you might begin to get a feeling for what some of that is about. And as we're looking at these symbols, I think that's a real good idea to try and do. This is the Egyptian god Horus. Horus, by the way, had four sons. Three of those sons were animals. One was an ox. One was a lion, and one was an eagle. It was a long time before Christianity used those same symbols for three of the evangelists. I thought you might be interested in knowing that symbology existed a long time beforehand.
What kind of bird is this
to be? This is a falcon. The falcon, on top of the falcon's head, is an image, as I understand it, is an image of the pharaoh. And that sort of snake-like form that we see there is that serpent is what was on the top of a pharaoh's staff. Those of you who have seen some of the horrible Hollywood versions of what was going on in Egypt always saw the pharaoh sitting up there holding the staff with a curly end on it, and that's what
was Horus also Osiris?
Yes.
Osiris.
Lion and eagle.
What? There's a lion and the eagle, and what's the other evangelist?
The ox.
There was also a human one, too, and I think in the evangelist there was also the angel. And here's another one of those combination forms. This is obviously another sphinx. The cultures, of course, these came from were people who were very, very attached to the land, very aware of the animals around them, very aware of their cyclic origins, something that we are not so much aware of. So when you look at these seem much more alien to us than some other symbols might. We're going to do some jumping around here. This, by the way, is one of my favorite pieces. I kind of threw it in just because I like it. This is early classical Greek bas-relief carved in marble, and this is the birth of Aphrodite, or Venus, as she came to be known later on. Venus is sometimes called the goddess of love. She is also a direct relationship to the earth goddess. And here she is being born, as the myth is, that she's being born out of the sacred waters and being brought up by two gods who are kind of bringing her into existence. But the kind of feeling I like about this is, we're going to be talking about birth later on, is that this is another one of those wonderful birth symbologies and or metaphors, if you will. When I look at this, I see a person being brought into existence, almost as if she's being brought from the womb of the earth into existence here, at least conscious existence. It's a very powerful kind of image to me. I don't have to understand it to sense some of the power and beauty behind it. Okay, we're going to talk about, as we jump several thousand years here, we're talking about now a more contemporary symbol. This has become a symbol for us. Okay, there is Uncle Sam. We see Uncle Sam, and we know what Uncle Sam means. What Uncle Sam means to you and I is very different than what Uncle Sam may mean to Nicaraguans, but nonetheless, Uncle Sam is still Uncle Sam. Okay. What is the difference between this symbology and this symbology? If you saw the same person now without the swastika on the armband and the swastika behind, you would think this is a poster for the Marines. The idea that we're using the same kind of symbol. And probably for the people who were pro-Nazi, this probably meant very similar things to the people who are pro-American. The important thing about a symbol is that a symbol can change because of your point of view about what that symbol is. Let's look at some more contemporary symbols. This is a common thing that you might find. It's a ketchup and mustard dispenser. It's saying, squeeze it. Obviously, it's made of plastic, and you can squish out your preferred condiment on your hamburger at your convenience. What kind of symbology, what are they really telling you here? What are they using to get you to buy their product? What is the subliminal message? Anyone want to take a stab?
Okay, it's almost like a sexual connotation. I get that. That was my first note. I don't know, I think they're appealing to something that maybe is going on inside, you know, or maybe an outbreak of, you know, recognized sexuality. I don't know. That's the first thing I hit me.
The colors.
The colors?
Yeah.
What about them?
Well, I look at the red, and I don't know, this might sound strange. I see male, and then I see yellow, and then I see female. That might sound strange.
Okay. Go ahead, Christine.
I see easy right in the middle.
Okay. You guys are doing very well. Anyone else want to see anything in there? Go ahead.
Well, the Q is one of those, you know, those symbols with, you know, the male-female symbol. I'd say be the female.
Okay.
When four.
I don't know what's in those things. It could be pretty crappy ketchup, but just seeing that red, you think, oh, it's got to be a neat tomato.
Okay, good. Now we're talking about all the subtleties, and I think it's really good. Yes, obviously they're using sexuality as a way of selling things. Sexuality is the way everyone markets things these days. It's not that those guys are bad for using it. They wouldn't use it if it didn't work. It works because that's something that is always on, seemingly, always on our mind, not individually, but as a collective culture. Why that's on our mind is another story that we'll talk about it in another time. Later in this class, in fact. But what we're talking about now is how what this does is it makes us feel a couple things. One, it excites us. It excites us both on a sexual way. I mean, obviously you see these two round forms sitting there in this one box, and it's got some very specific kinds of connotations to it. It excites us in a color way. Color was raised because these are intense kind of colors. They are hot colors, if you will. That's another word that has connotations. It excites us in a sensual way as opposed to sexual because squeeze it. Mm-hmm. And there you have this picture of this thing being squishing out. It almost looks like some red slug sort of generating out on top of that hamburger. So it's appealing to us on all of those things. And someone else said easy. Okay, I'm sure that whoever came up with the squeeze it kind of sign also said not only is this all those things about sensuality and sexuality, but it's easy sensuality, easy sexuality, and it'll taste good too. All that stuff is implied right there in that symbology. This is the kind of symbology that's probably closer to you guys because it's one that's more contemporary, but it certainly is part of what we're talking about. Let's take that same idea and push it a little bit further. Okay. This is the cover to a magazine. It's not a particularly good slide. We all have seen magazines of varying kinds. What is being told to you about this particular piece? What do you see when you see that?
Fashion.
Fashion, sex. Okay, what makes it sexy to you?
The line of the ankle of the legs falling down, and the heels raising up. What color?
Well, you think of the pose that's connected to the leg.
Mm.
And how, you can think of maybe the high heel can bring that maybe slinky dress, and the leg is, you know, slid up the side.
Okay, right. This
also
is
bondage.
No, that's a real important part of it.
Dependence out of that.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, I can understand that too, because I think that's another side, a slightly different interpretation of the same issue. And I hold on to that. I want to get back to that. I still have a little time for it. But one of the things that a symbol can become, even if it isn't a symbol that is as mysterious as talking about God, this is a different kind of mystery. And in fact, in our culture, despite the fact that there's a lot more freedom of expression sexually now than there was, say, 30, 40 years ago, there is still a great deal of mystery about that, a great deal of mystery of how men and women relate, and a great deal of mystery about how that all happens to be. So there's a lot of symbology about expressing that mystery. Since most of us, despite the fact, have ideas about it, it all is rather confusing to us. And we need to rely on dogma, opinion, or symbology to help us understand or at least grab a hold of that mystery. And Theo had the right idea, I think, in this case, is because we see just an ankle and a foot that is such a shapely sort of form that we imply all the rest. I mean, you're not going to expect to see an 80-year-old grandmother attached to that leg. You're not going to want to, your father probably doesn't have a foot that looks like that. So the implication is very particular about what it's describing. Now, the other thing that it's describing is the someone who seems to be rather free. Some woman who is going to be walking in that shoe is not going to be a prude, probably. So when in terms of independence, what I think that may be saying is the freedom to be able to express your own sensuality. And that may be part of it as well. Okay, let's continue with that just a bit. Kate brought up the issue of bondage, and I think that's a really important part of it. Most of the time, I've talked to people and I've watched it at PLU, who will be wearing short skirts and wearing a little anklet. What happens when you see that little anklet on that that particular person? And why would one want to have a piece of jewelry all the way down over there?
Oh, what you mean like the ankle bracelet?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah.
Well, yes, it attracts your attention down to their ankle, I suppose. But what does it do? It suddenly makes you realize that this is a naked leg. You know that it's a naked leg because you are dressing it with something that is just barely recognizable as an ornament. That's what ornamentation is for. So when we look at this particular shoe, we see that this is probably a short skirt because we are aware of the nakedness that is implied by that thing of bondage that's there. That idea of contraction implies the opposite. It's something that symbology plays with us all the time. You cannot have one thing without, at least by inference, the other. It's an important way symbols work. So when you're thinking about your own symbols, you're thinking about how you might symbolize your own childhood, you might think about how one way of looking at it infers the other way of looking at it. Okay, that was the last slide, I think, as it came to symbols, was it? Yes, it was. Are there any questions about it so far? You want to have a bit of a review of some of this stuff?
How about a reverse review, just going through slides backwards? How's that?
Sure, if I can figure out how to do that. Whoops, whoops, no, no, that's not it. There, that's it. Okay.
One thing I think about it right away is that just that this person is, you know, really into fashion or something, and maybe, you know, that they're caught up in maybe the bondage or the bonded to the society that's so important.
Yeah.
Okay, real good point. Yeah.
And you wouldn't think of this as being an ugly person at all, even if it's, you know, young. You know it's not a grandma, but you think of a nice person.
The thing that's really interesting is a side issue, is I know a lot of people who left.
Excuse me.
They have specific models just for hands and feet. And the reason they have them for hands and feet is usually the rest of the body doesn't match. So consequently, when they're trying to find the perfect and wonderful ideal foot, never is attached to them. Usually they're overweight and kind of dumpy. And so I think what's important about that is the mythology of beauty. Because we all grow up with this incredible myth about what fashion and beauty and handsomeness and all that stuff is, and we struggle to restrict our bodies and make ourself fit into whatever that is. And it's not only is it a waste of time and money, but it's something that's extremely powerful. My point in saying that is a metaphor. The power that fashion has over us is a metaphor for the culture that we are in. And if we look at that as a metaphor, we can extrapolate some very powerful information about it. And if we keep looking at a lot of these narrow little subject things that we talk about in class, you'll be able to form your own opinions and extrapolate your own ideas about those implications. Kai, did you have anything else to say about that?
No.
Anyone else?
When I first saw it, I thought of like we're at the level of the foot. You know, you rarely see someone wearing a shoe like that. Usually you look down on it. So I felt kind of like dominance or oppression, and in a way aggressiveness. Like there should be somebody, you know, like she's maybe set me on somebody.
That's a very good point.
I like that.
Plus also the color.
Yeah, the
color.
The color. I didn't know that too.
Vantage points, yeah.
Oh, just because you have a picture of a foot, that means, wait a minute, there must be something special about this foot. So you can.
What's the vantage point?
That adds another. That makes me think it must be special. Something must be unique about it. So it makes you start thinking about why is it unique and start going off on these other.
Okay, right. That's a point of view, which I guess is what vantage point is saying too, is that is true. Anytime you focus in on detail, you start extrapolating without even thinking about it, what is the significance of this detail? Those of you who are film buffs, that every once in a while in some strange film will be a close-up of some obscure place. And you instantly start saying, oh, this is significant. What does it mean? What is this all about? And maybe it just meant that the photographer just sort of slipped that time. Who knows? But we all automatically try and find meaning in things, and oftentimes there may not be meaning. But what's powerful about that isn't whether there exists meaning, but what is the subjective meaning that it brings out in you. I don't know how many people have been to a psychologist and taken Rorschach tests where you see an ink blot. And you look at that ink blot and you say, oh yeah, this reminds me of my Uncle Sam when the car died and he had to walk back and he got stuck in the snowdrift, or whatever it is. I think the important part of that is that the symbology works because it becomes a projection of yourself. Oftentimes when we see things that we don't like and we say to ourselves, oh, this is really horrible, oh, this is something they shouldn't allow to be seen, what we're talking about is not the thing. We're talking about what we are projecting onto that. And when you're thinking about symbology, think about how symbols wind up being a very tight beam sort of hook, pulling out information from you. That's a metaphor, a web, how you can use that as a metaphor for yourself. Your personal reaction to something is really important, not because your reaction is what it is, but because that reaction is saying something about yourself. It's getting closer to time. Yes?
A lot of these things I didn't think of. Are we kind of saying that these are a lot of things that maybe our subconscious is picking up when we aren't thinking about?
Precisely.
Because I don't know,
To me, that magazine looks like it's old because of the colors and because of the style, but it also looks like, no matter what, that she's got to be expensive. It's got to be pricey, it's got to be sexy, because the bands are so narrow and tiny. And it's real feminine because of that little doohickey on the ankle. And it's real uncomfortable.
Yeah, I'm sure that. All right, I want to say that it brought to my attention that I'm giving you a lot of information and it's sometimes difficult to take notes about it all. I know that sometimes you have to kind of think to digest it before you can write it. Well, I understand that, and I'm not testing you on the information so much as I'm giving you a kind of a broad background of some of the issues that may be relevant. The way I think, what I think you ought to do, and what I would do if I were in your place, is I would compare notes. Some of you are going to take notes about some things, others are going to take notes about other things, and if you compare notes, you'll probably flesh out your understanding of it. So rely on each other as helpers in digesting and talking about the information, and talking is another important thing. You may take some notes now and you know exactly what your notes are, but if you're anything like me, if you don't refer to them fairly soon, you won't remember at all what it is you wrote about. So take some opportunity if you're interested to talk to your compatriots about it. Okay, what I want to talk about now is I want to talk about birth. I want to talk about birth as a reality, birth as a symbol, and I want to relate that to yourselves. We'll probably do a small free writing exercise as well. And I then also want to talk about the shrines, because we're getting time to start dealing with that. Some information about the shrines I don't yet have. Hopefully, I'll be able to get that information to you all this afternoon. Namely, where do we work? I really haven't figured that one out yet, so we need to figure that out. You're going to have to start cutting and pasting and drawing and doing all kinds of those horrible anxiety-producing exercises you've all been waiting for, and we just don't know where we're at. So before I start talking about birth, I think somewhere here I wanted you guys to do a pre-write. I'm wondering where it is I wanted you to do it. Do you remember what it was we talked about? I've forgotten now, because I can't seem to find it. My notes are too scattered. Oh, okay, no, never mind, it's not about that. Anyway, that's all I take now.
That's Wednesday.
Okay, no, but I want to talk about what birth is. So why don't you tell me what birth is to you? What does it mean?
Entry.
An entry.
An entry. Okay.
Beginning.
A beginning.
Life.
Start. Life. Start.
An awakening.
Awakening. Okay. That's pretty much
kind of new awareness.
A new awareness. Okay, so it's like not just awareness, but a new kind of awareness. That's probably why where the born again sort of idea comes in.
Miracle.
Okay, good. Birth as miraculous. Very good.
Freshness.
Freshness. Okay. Any other thoughts come to mind?
Manifestation. Not more as yourself, but as other people seeing it. Instead of, you know, all these going from the inside out, what birth is. From us out, but for other people looking in, it's kind of a manifestation of the life.
Okay, good. All right, so we all pretty much have some basic ideas about what birth is. Beginning, newness. Sometimes it also means kind of naiveness to some people. A beginning oftentimes means that you're ignorant, despite the fact that you're ignorant not in terms of stupid, but ignorant in terms of not really, really knowing. But when you're looking at what birth is about, it's very difficult for all of us to understand a peculiarity of Western culture. Since most of us grow up in a Western culture, and we have, although there are some of us who have lived abroad, most of us have lived abroad in Western situations, if it's the military or in Europe, which is essentially we are essentially a modern manifestation of European culture here, so the differences are more subtle. But Western, especially industrialized Western, societies have very specific points of view that we accept so readily and unconsciously that we don't know how to look at it from outside of ourselves because we are too much in ourselves. One of the peculiarities about them is the idea of looking at an event or a subject as if it is isolated from everything else. Talking about birth, it's very difficult to understand birth without also having, by implication, the idea of death. It was really interesting, too, last night, the Vespers, we talked about that very same issue. how it is symbolized in Christian mythology. It's also symbolized in our own personal mythology, although we don't know it. What I think about is that old Kodak kind of image of an old grandparent playing with a toddler. And there we see that whole kind of cyclic thing in front of us all the time. So when you think about birth, and we think about newness and youthfulness and awakening, we also have to think about death and oldness and going to sleep. Sometimes that's difficult because for the majority of people in our culture, the idea of death and termination is a very difficult one to confront. Not in terms of just alone in the realization that it's going to happen, but just in terms of what that means to the way we live our lives. What Western technology does is what Western society does is it looks at life in a linear way. There's a beginning and there's an end. Now, sometimes we, excuse me?
Input, output.
Input, output, yes. Entry, exit, all those sorts of things. In terms of the facts of the population, we probably make up about, people who feel that way probably make up about 25% of the population in the world. So most of the people in the world don't look at the world as beginning and ending, don't look at it as a linear way. They look at it as a cyclic way. The cycle meaning that birth and death are not the beginning and the end, they are just different aspects of the same thing of life that is ongoing. When we think about the earth and we think about death symbology often is the winter. Birth symbology is often the spring, but the cycle keeps coming back. When you think about plants, many plants die to produce the seeds that reproduce the species. We don't recognize individual plants. We don't give them names like Homer, but we certainly recognize the species and come to appreciate the flowers as they come back every spring. Since we are given the gift of consciousness, and we have the idea that we are in fact individuals with this little ego of ours, or the mythology that we are individuals with this ego of ours, we tend to look at birth and death in a very subjective way, which causes us immense amounts of anxiety. The way we have chosen to deal with that anxiety is to develop rituals. There are rituals about birth, there are rituals about death, and there are rituals about what I call little births and little deaths. Most of us have experienced little births and little deaths repeatedly in our lives, although we may not have called it that. Russell Baker experiences one very early in the book, and it's the one that comes to mind to me, which is what happens when he moves. Not only does his father die and all the rest of that stuff, but he actually experiences a death of his own kind of life when he moves away from his little country home. Part of Russell Baker actually dies, although he may not know it at the time. And as he moves into his new place, although it takes a while for him to come into consciousness and realization, part of him is born. The part of him that gets born may not always be a comfortable part of him. It may not be a part of him that he understands, and maybe he won't understand it until he gets to be an adult, but nonetheless, that happens. In your own life, moving is one thing, going to school is another. What are some of the other places where we have ritual birth and death experiences in our lives that our culture provides for us?
Graduation,
okay, what else?
Marriage,
good. What kind of transition are these now? They're like whole new ways of living, are they? Ideally, anyway. What else?
Confirmation.
Any others?
Retirement.
What others?
Marriage
is already mentioned, but yeah, marriage, that's true.
Maybe. Just going away to school, to college, moving
okay.
out.
Moving out, that's a real important one. Probably a lot more important than most of us know when we're doing it.
Maybe 16 or
21. Yeah, certain birthdays.
Okay, especially if a driver's license or a legality with alcohol is concerned, those things are real important, or voting age, things like that.
New career?
Okay, that's also a point.
Going away parties, like at jobs, you know, when you leave a job,
okay.
Death of parents, family.
Okay, the actual death of a person, sure, we have a very elaborate ritual experiences going along with that. We'll talk about these in a minute. Yeah, go ahead.
Spiritually, like when a person becomes reborn or if they believe in that type of thing where their life changes.
Okay. Baptisms, sure.
Sexual transition, like senior virginity.
Uh-huh, sure. Or just entering into adolescence, which is a real biggie.
What about divorce?
Actually, it's interesting you mention that. Up until recently, there had not been rituals involving divorce. But now they started having divorce parties. And I think that they're real important, and we'll talk about what makes them important in a minute.
The other day I saw some first divorce card. Heard you're getting divorced. It was kind of horrible.
They have a show on television now. Divorce court.
Yeah, a lot of people experience that, and there is no ritual for it. And people feel the lack of a ritual, and so they start inventing one. We'll talk about why we do that in a minute. But what other ritual experiences are there? Even in a kind of more narrower focus, let's think about life at PLU. What kind of ritual experiences exist?
Maybe when you go to eat the whole world.
Okay, both, yeah. You want to say it louder so we all hear that?
Going to eat with people.
Okay, eating. The breaking of bread together can become an important kind of ritual, even if it's not in a spiritual context.
Finals.
Sure. What else?
Living with somebody else.
Moving in with someone else. Yeah, there are all kinds of rituals that happen, especially as the semester begins on that score.
Dead week.
Dead week becomes ritualized, sure.
Initiation week.
Uh-huh.
Just every weekend or day-to-day.
Okay, right. Let's look then at a day. What kind of ritualistic experiences do you go through in a day? Milk call, waking up in the morning, off for money, maybe.
Going running.
What is the difference between ritual and habit?
Ritual might be something that is could be a brand new experience or something that is not. I think it's either to do habit, or habit is just something you don't think about that you do all the time, I guess. A ritual would be something separate from a habit.
Doesn't the ritual
have more meaning?
Go ahead, I didn't hear you.
Doesn't the ritual have more meaning than the habit? I mean, sure, you're doing the habit because you have to get somewhere, like, if I didn't get out of bed, I would show up at your class, but I mean, but I think the ritual has maybe more personal meaning.
How many people have here in the class have, like, since we're in a Christian context, have attended church, a ritual at church, and really were bored to death and had absolutely no personal investment at that particular time? Most of us have experienced that once or twice in our lives, I'm sure.
Maybe ritual has something to do with, a ritual is something that others recognize. Like a divorce, do something for your roommate. It's a ritual, how you get ready in the morning because your roommate recognizes that since she has an earlier class, she has to be quiet and that type of thing. But a habit is something that you just sort of fall into, more of a pattern, not really a pattern, something that just happens that's not significant necessarily and that others don't really recognize, which is why church might be a ritual, because even though you aren't personally involved in it, others recognize that you are going to church, whereas a habit would be if you went all by yourself and you still were bored and it didn't make any difference to you anyway. You went just because.
It probably is a habit for more.
Yeah.
There's a fine line. Maybe a ritual, I would think, probably for myself, like going to church is a ritual, and sometimes it falls into a habit. There's a fine line of ritual. It has more meaning as habit. It's just something I do because I do it. In a ritual, there is a reason why I do it. I just don't do it because I have done it and I will do it. Okay. There's a fine line.
Can we see if we can make a this is important for later on because it seems to be getting tangential here, but if we can figure out what is the difference then in more specific terms.
Maybe personal input on yourself. I mean, if you're consciously aware of what you're doing, then it's more like a ritual, and if you just kind of do it without really thinking about it, then it's like,
okay, I think we're all scratching at the basic idea. Ritual is there, I think, to help us become aware of the transition that it is usually there to mark. For instance, it may sound very mundane, but every morning I usually have a cup of espresso coffee. It's something I'm extremely aware of. It's not just something I do because I want to do it or something I do unconsciously. It's something that makes the day valuable to me. It's something that marks the difference between kind of groggily brushing my teeth and sticking clothes on my back to when the day actually begins. So it's a real important, it's like the sun rising long before the sun rises usually. So that's ritualistic for me, although it may not be ritualistic for other people. It has that very important time. Just like church, sometimes a service can do that for some people. And other times it can.
Laurie, you're imparting a meaning on having coffee more than some people might.
Right.
That's the difference. It's not just a habit with you, but you do certain things in certain order.
Right, so it has very special significance to me personally. So there are individual rituals. I know people who ritually light their one cigarette they allow themselves to have because it's significant to them trying not to smoke and giving themselves one. So it's a very ritualistic way of impressing upon themselves the importance of that particular moment. But the thing that I want to get to in terms of what ritual is there for is what needs does it meet? What are the needs that rituals do for us? What would happen if we had no rituals? What would life be like without them?
Rituals kind of give understanding, and like you were saying, in describing metaphors, rituals act as a metaphor for the entire transition. And it's something that we need to help us understand. We can't look at the whole in time, but we can look at the ritual and maybe project something on the whole.
Very good. What the rituals do is allows us to have that free space to be able to experience the transition. I don't know how many people here have experienced deaths in the family, but that's a real excellent way of noticing that. Some people, in the past anyway, really thought that funerals were kind of crummy, and so they wouldn't really have very much in the way of a kind of a funeral experience. People say, oh, I hate funerals, it's just sort of depressing and horrible, and just people are sitting around crying, and who cares anyway? The person's gone, they're gone. But funerals, at their best, are very powerful ways of getting us to acknowledge our grief, acknowledge the person that is no longer there, to re-experience and connect with the family that now has to go through life without this close person, and to then rebirth and move on in a new kind of context. That's what rituals are. Rituals are basically rebirthing experiences. Every ritual we have is there purposefully, whether we know it or not, to help us transit and the death and birth part. Everything we have mentioned here in terms of a place for those rituals are exactly that. So we experience a rebirthing in some level of our lives, maybe daily, maybe yearly, certainly very often. The thing that's important about these rituals is not so much to be self-conscious about them, but to experience them in a way that helps us understand the importance of them, like finals particularly. Whenever I'm talking to a student during final week, they're usually stressed out, they hate it, they don't even know why they're in school, they're fearful that they're not going to do very well, and they're just struggling through all this nonsense, feeling a great deal of pain and anxiety. When final week is over, after a week or two anyway, and they look back on it, they sort of re-experience it as sort of, yeah, you know, that was really kind of neat. Now I feel sort of relieved, I feel clean, it's over, it's like it's a new day, I can get sleep, I can see my family, I'm a new person and new classes and I'm ready to continue on. It's that important part of having something end allows us to be able to appreciate the beginning much more. If we didn't experience that ending, we would never understand what beginning is about. It's that kind of holistic sort of thing. You can't have one without another. Yeah, Kate.
Oh, I was just thinking in terms of my own divorce that going through it allowed me to come to a new relationship. But until I could get closure on that, I couldn't open up to the next possibilities.
Yeah.
And also, and just my emotional feel is sometimes things like funerals, divorces, retirement, it gives people a closure, but it also allows them to support people that they might feel uncomfortable about supporting. I'm thinking, being raised in Minnesota, all the men get on their country suits and they put their hands behind their backs and they're very polite and they really watch. But their being there is their way of giving support to the marriage, the divorce, the funeral, whatever. They don't have to say anything, and they feel real awkward talking, but their being there is their way of dealing with it, seeing the people and feeling like it's an event. Somehow it helps everybody.
Christine.
I was just going to say, it's really interesting you brought up that point, because that was brought up in Leslie Baker's book, too, in death, when the father had died, and how it was so important for the widow to know that all the people were there to show the support, to show that it was well-liked, or to, you know, to give that support and that presence and not saying much. And I just, I mean, I got that same feeling, so that you got that too. I just,
autobiographies usually are based on reality, so it's kind of nice how we can sort of find our own reality. The importance of all this stuff, too, is when you're looking back at your childhood, is to think about all, it seems to me that watching children grow up, and having experienced it at least once myself, I'm real aware of the fact that there are many little births and deaths in a childhood, so many, because so many experiences are so incredibly new. The little births and deaths of having a toy and the toy breaking, or just the fact that you suddenly have to be in kindergarten, or various things in the house that you've come to rely on change or not. When you're looking back at your own childhood, what I think I'd like you to do is to try and remember what, or as many of those little births and deaths as you can. When you're trying to develop your own symbology, it's very difficult to find that without some kind of a hook to hang it on. Ritual and little births and deaths are a part of that exploration. I don't expect that all of you are going to be able to find all that many right away. Some of you have looked hard enough that maybe it won't be a new experience. Others, it will be such a new experience you won't know where to begin. And I'll give you some guidelines about how to do that. That's one of the reasons you brought your childhood picture and your toy with you. Some of you did. Okay, let me just refer to my notes here to make sure I haven't missed anything here. Sure.
Can I ask you about habit? You never really clarified that. So the difference between ritual and habit is that ritual makes the difference. I mean, it has that personal significance.
Personal significance, I think, is probably the biggest difference. Some people habitually go about rituals, or ritualistically go about habits, but basically speaking, the difference is that you are aware of the fact that it is a significant activity that helps transit one consciousness level to another.
So habits are just something you do because you do it.
Right. Like habit may be biting your fingernail.
Sometimes unthinking. You know, like, you may have a cup of coffee in the morning and just scarf it down, but not Lori. Man, he's got all this personal significance and meaning attached to it. It's a big deal. It's almost like a tea ceremony based on what he's saying.
Almost. I'm not quite that restrictive.
Oh, I don't know.
I mean, I actually brought my own espresso pot with me here because it's focusing on a symbolic event or music yet, but that's another issue. Okay, so we all understand this stuff so far.
Yeah, basically, it's about it.
Okay. Excuse me?
Christy and I were saying, you know, how that might affect you not having your chance for your daily ritual, how that might... Just being snotty over here, no problem.
That's sort of what I thought.
Yeah.
I have to mark that down.
I said, Christine and I, what is that Christine?
For you, Jenna.
Okay, there is an implication to all this that I might have already said. Let me sort of repeat it because I think it's really important. Any description cannot exist without or implies other states of being. So birth is meaningless without death, or in more easily to understand terms, newness means nothing without also knowing oldness. The thing that I was trying to say before, which I think I never completed, was the idea that Western thought tries to look at birth as a single thing. You think about birth and it's just, yes, babies or newness. You don't think about the fact that it exists in a context. You can't not understand black unless it is next to white. You cannot understand anything unless it is next to something that creates contrast to it. So as you're going about looking at yourselves and your images, as you're going about looking at concepts, talk, making conversations, be aware of the fact that things don't exist in a vacuum. They exist in a context. Your childhood existed in a context. It's a context that you know so well, that you experience so subjectively, that you look through with such blinders that oftentimes you don't understand the nature of that context. in my experience, I think that I don't believe I understood the nature of my context until I got old enough to be able to experience other families and other ways of looking at things. Then I was able to understand them. Maybe some of you are at that point in your lives now, maybe some of you aren't, but it's a valuable thing to kind of look at and through. One of the disadvantages of going to PLU is you all go to a school that pretty much has people coming from the same economic group, same cultural background, same point of view. Now that has advantages too that I think are very important, but it's something that you should be aware of, that one of the ways that you can look at your own lives more clearly is to sort of have a stereo vision, to see it the same, a lifetime from a very different perspective. Maybe some of you in your own lives will have that opportunity, or those of you who have lived overseas may have already done that. So what I'd like you to get to do over time when you have the few seconds to recreate is after you sort of played and you don't think about the class any, as you're talking to each other, get to know each other. Find out what your similarities are and what your differences are. In the process of doing that, you'll remember things about your own childhood. You'll remember things about yourself. You'll share observations of others that will help give you that stereoptic vision. We all know that we share things in common, and we all know that we have differences, but we don't know very well what they are. Holden Village gives us a marvelous opportunity to step on each other's toes. We're going to be living so close together. So let's use it. Let's make this experience something different than it might be if you were at PLU with all your other classes to deal with and all those other people who don't have the same context. Later on this afternoon, we're going to experience our own birthday party. We have a little carrot cake that we've made, and we're going to sort of sing happy birthday to us and all the rest of that stuff. It won't be of any great significance, except that we will be reiterating the fact that we as a group, we as a tribal identity, are experiencing, or indeed have already experienced, our birth. And now what we're doing is we're beginning to experience our toddler stage. So here we are, beginning to toddle around. Now what that means is that we probably haven't learned to talk yet. What I'm doing, what Kate's doing, is we're giving you the language. And like any toddlers, if you can remember, if you have any very early childhood memories of what it's like, it's just filled with a great deal of anxiety, trying to be able to communicate, trying to be able to understand, trying to be able to find your role in the world. The world usually exists not much farther than the arms of your mother, and if you're lucky, your father as well, and maybe a few small rooms and a couple pots and pans or whatever toys you may be playing with at the time. So anyway, I kind of anticipated myself a little bit.
So in other words, find out what the similarities and differences are to clarify your own context.
Yeah, exactly. What I'd like to do, it's now 11:05. I do want to talk about the shrines a bit. So before I talk about the shrines, what I'd like to do is give you 5 minutes to do your first free write. I want you to free write for me, and I'll tell you when to begin, so you might want to get your paper ready, on what you think a shrine is. I don't expect a lot of you are going to have a specific idea. Now, I think I've told you generally what a free write is before, but let me do it again, just in case some of you are still confused about it. What I want you to do is just take your pen and get ready, maybe even put it right down on that blank piece of paper, and then start writing without thinking. Don't bother thinking at all. Some of the time when I'm doing free writing, what I do is say, I start writing like, here I am writing, I'm supposed to be writing about a shrine, I don't know what a shrine is anyway, boy, I really wish I were somewhere else, I'm feeling tired. If that's what you're thinking about, that's what you're writing about. But try, as you're thinking, to direct your thoughts, and at the same time, your hand, to talk about what you think a shrine is to you. Don't worry about whether it's right or wrong. Right or wrong is not the point. You all got it? Everybody ready with their blank pieces of paper? And okay? I'm going to wait until the minute changes, so you're going to actually have maybe a few seconds to kind of figure this out. I don't have a second indicator, so you may have to wait the longest 30 seconds in your life.
Yeah.
How was it, by the way? Did it surprise some of you? Was it hard for others of you? Chances are it's one of those things that sometimes will be difficult and you won't know what to write and you think it's pretty silly. And other times, suddenly these thoughts are going to occur, and no matter how much time, it doesn't seem to be enough. And it won't be consistent. Sometimes it'll be easy for the same person and then hard at another time. What I'd like to do now is share some of the things we've written. What do some of you think a shrine is? Marty?
Well, maybe right at the road here?
No, just sort of give me a basic idea. If you could glance at it.
I just said it's like a black space, a hole of unknown origin that you're looking towards it for something of significance for you. You throw yourself, you shove yourself towards it. You're in darkness and you're trying to get yourself into the light by reaching out towards something that has meaning or will be so much significant to you than what you think about it. What you are about in this world, universe, heaven, hell, that surrounds or supposedly exists outside the skin or the body that you are enclosed within.
Okay. Sort of a metaphysical approach to a definition of it, but I think it's a good one. What is some of the rest of you? What are some of the rest
of you? I saw it as a place of worship. You know, you think of going to shrines, and here it's maybe, you know, an altar, and on top of the altar there are a bunch of things that are symbols of something that's worthy of worship. And you might not understand all those symbols, and you might not like all of them for some reason. So I think like a shrine of ourselves, in order to do that, we must, I mean, it's a place that most likely the other people won't worship. It's a place where we can worship our own selves. And that kind of implies that you need in some way to like yourself or like something about you to be able to acknowledge that you're worthy to be worshiped.
Mine is really different because you said shrine. The first thing I thought was, I don't know if you guys, Shriners? Do you guys know? And my grandpa was a Shriner, and that sent me, and my grandpa died. It was a year ago, and it was really weird, and that sent me off into a whole thing about death and life. It's really weird.
Rewrites will do that. And so you might want to, never mind. I won't tell you to look at that as a metaphor. I'll say that enough later on. What else have you thought about?
I wrote about how it's something that people set up to remember a meaning or a philosophy or a person that they think we shouldn't forget.
Okay.
Along those same lines I wrote about, I had a hard time writing about what I thought it was for me, so when you said that, all I could think of was when I read this article about Tutankhamun and his shrine that they found and all the things in it that symbolized his life and what he liked and his power and all that stuff, and so that's how because I had a hard time thinking of it for myself.
Uh-huh. Okay, that's good. What else?
Well, when I think of shrines, the pictures come in my mind are like a big Buddha shrine, mm-hmm. It's a huge old Buddha, or a shrine Catholic with Mary Magdalene out, you know, they have a backyard or whatever. I think of those two things as shrines, and I kind of went from there and thought, well, what are shrines for then? I kind of came up with them. It's a place where I'm totally dedicated to where it tries and gives you a sense of that being or thing. And the whole idea, that one place, and the whole is to try and give a sense of what it is and who it was and what they lived for, what they are, what it was.
Okay, that's good. Are you raising your hand?
Yeah, like what Theo was saying, it can kind of fulfill a need to have something solid to look at, like when they built the golden cow in the Bible. They
can't
live with just thinking about it. They want to have something to look at.
Tangible representation of something.
Yeah.
Okay. Anybody else? Everyone's sort of ideas pretty much get expressed?
I had another idea that shrines kind of set apart from everything else.
Yeah.
I don't see a shrine in the middle of, it's not in its surrounding, it's kind of by itself. And you don't view it in its surrounding, you view it as one separate thing.
Okay, good.
My definition was very similar to Tom's, however, I didn't see it as necessarily something that we acknowledge that there's something positive about ourselves that we need to worship, but rather something mystical or something very vague and hazy that we do need to acknowledge about ourselves.
Okay. Yeah, a real good point. Anyone else want to add anything to that? Kate, you want to add anything to it?
Well, besides religious shrine, I remember when I was a kid going to the Washington Monument, and also now if I went, I'd probably see the Vietnam Memorial. And to me, that's a national shrine or a historic shrine. And somehow it's an object of reverence, or that you want to give respect to the persons or person as, I don't know, who's the first person, I guess?
Marty.
Also, when I was traveling, I've seen a lot of shrines, like in Okinawa, people dedicate their whole lives toward preserving the shrines of their parents or their grandparents, so they live in the shrines, and they're just huge, and they spend their whole income on the shrines, so it's a major thing. Seeing a Madonna in a bathtub on a road, that's a shrine, or seeing wood boxes with peaked roofs in Japan, and also shrines with skeletons in them. Mexico, there are all sorts of shrines along the road. If someone dies, they'll put up a shrine. There's all kinds of meanings to shrines, and the difference between a shrine and something else. I'm not really sure.
Okay. Christine, you
have... If somebody died, like, would a shrine be like a cross on the side of the road, like somebody died in Montana? I don't know if it does. Somebody put a cross up for that? Is it just a symbol?
I think that's just more of a symbol than it is. However, in Greece, they do have shrines for that same reason. But they're not just crosses. They're actual boxes.
And they
come back, the families come back and burn incense inside. They're very elaborate.
Flowers, notes, messages, wishes, hopes, poetry. It's all kinds of stuff. Standing there by the road.
What do you think their ideas of the shrines are, these people who spend their whole lives keeping on for something?
I'm not one of them, so it's hard to tell.
Yeah, well, everybody does it. And if you don't, you won't have much of an afterlife. And you don't honor your parents. You're pretty damned in that particular culture.
Let's get back to our culture first, anyway, and knock these things off and see what time it is. And then we can sort of elaborate a bit. But let's see if we can talk about what some of the generalized words we can now condense this down to what a shrine is. To me, Todd had one of the points that I think is real important about it, is that there's a mystery about a shrine. To me, a shrine is a representation of a mystery. I think Marty talked about it too. Marty's writing about the mystery itself. But that when you think about religious shrine, it's obvious that we're talking about a kind of concept of God or divinity that we may have, that we wish to worship, that is larger than ourselves. Like, I think most of us can accept the fact that despite that we all grow up in a particular kind of spiritual dogma that is a form of understanding God, it is nonetheless so much larger than what we are, we can only understand it symbolically or metaphorically. It's very hard to have a total understanding of it. So a shrine is something that has that mystical quality. It's like a symbol, where it implies something that is greater than the sum of its parts. The word I use all the time is synergy, which is basically defined as a whole that is greater than the sum of its parts, and so a shrine is synergistic. Theo mentioned that a shrine was somehow isolated. So what I would say is a shrine occupies a special place, both outside and inside. What I mean by that is that shrines are often, even if in small rooms, are in little corners set aside from the basic other activity of a room or space, or perhaps in an entire room itself. Those of you who have gone through some of the cathedrals in Europe will notice that they often will have, apart from the altar itself, shrines, small shrines dedicated to particular saints or whatever, all the way up and down the aisle, I guess, on either left or right side. oftentimes. So they're very isolated in terms of the external space. They also are isolated in terms of the internal space. Oftentimes a shrine will be a consolidated environment. If it has a particular relic that's in there, a cup or a bone, or in your case, a childhood toy, the childhood toy is placed in this internal space almost as if it is stilled in time. You can almost hear the proverbial pin drop. It's that internal space that is confined and isolated in one way or another that makes it a very special hallowed space. Now that hallowed could be a spiritual space, or as Kate pointed out, it could have other kinds of things. For instance, the Washington Monument is in some ways a shrine to George Washington. Now George Washington, when we think about him as Americans, we don't just think of an old man with wooden teeth. We think about somebody who was the father of our country, and that has all kinds of implications about it. All kinds of mythologies are about this one particular individual. Probably it has nothing to do with George Washington as much as it has to do with the need we have to personify this particular idea of birth again. The birthing of a country. But at any rate, so it has that kind of space. Shrines are about emotional experiences. They're about feelings. When you have a space to have the shrine, it is something that you can experience something in. So you go there at a shrine and you kind of get yourself settled in and you have your kind of meditative state, and this kind of is a place where you can do that. It reflects some of that. It allows you to experience that non-conscious as opposed to unconscious, that feeling of what it is you're talking about. It's not exactly like a church service where you're going through a ritual. It's the place where you can more personally experience that kind of thing. Most shrines are very small. They usually are for one person or a small group of people. So shrines have that very personal quality. Shrines are not displays, and this is one of the important things about when you're setting up your own shrine. It's not a place where you just kind of have a showcase and you display objects. So a shrine is not just a place to show you the object. A shrine is a place to elevate the object and make, no matter what the mundaneness of an object is, make it into a have it be. My cold is, obviously my pill is wearing off, my nose is beginning to stuff up, so my words are beginning to get caught in my throat somewhere. But I think I can make it through this lecture. You are elevating what may be a mundane object into a greater place. You take a mundane object and make it into a symbol. I remember once I had this little tiny metal play car, the kind of things that haven't been made for many, many years. And in fact, it was an old toy when I got it. But that little toy symbolized not just my own childhood, but it reminded me of all the strange and wonderful feelings I had about my own childhood, which has a smell and a texture and a color and a feel and a temperature, and has all these sorts of feelings that I place into this one object. And so when I look at that object again, I re-experience that feeling. Not always as powerfully. Sometimes I experience it more powerfully than others, but nonetheless, that object has that. So when you're dealing with your shrines, what I want you to try and do is to develop a small, I certainly would like you to keep it small, environment that your object is placed in. This environment is going to be one you're going to be very restricted in doing because you don't have junkyards to go to. You can certainly look through the garbage over here to see if there's something you can use. I mean, maybe a shrine. But you have your toy. And you have the outside world here. You might find nature is a good resource for finding things. But you need to make it fit some of these criteria. The best way to have you understand how that works is to have you ask questions. And I plan on making myself very available toward giving workshops, how you cut cardboard and paste it together. And as soon as we can get ourselves set up, I'll have all of our materials right out there so we can play with it and see what that's like. The problem with making visual art is you can't talk about it very much until you get in there and try and do it. There is no shortcut about it. So the anxiety you're feeling right now, don't worry so much about it. Just think about what it might be. We'll have a workshop, we'll play with some materials, and over time that will evolve. In fact, we didn't talk about it, but I think the shrine should be on Monday, if that's acceptable. So, okay, so do we have a better idea of what the shrine is? At least in words.
Let me show you some slides. Some of these slides are not shrines. In fact, none of these slides are really shrines. They're all box sculptures. That is to say, they are like reliquaries. A reliquary is a cabinet for relics. The difference between a cabinet for relics than a shrine is a shrine is a place of worship, a reliquary is just a place of storage, even if it is honored storage. But we'll look at some things that are more like displays as well, and you'll get a better idea then of what you are not going to be doing as opposed to what you are going to be doing. Also, these slides were originally designed for the course that is given at PLU, so we expected more of the results than I am expecting here. Okay, these are three individual sculptures by a guy named Joseph Cornell, who's a rather well-known artist, American artist. And he has these objects that in some ways are in between displays and shrines. He uses found objects, everyday things he can find in garbage cans. In fact, I had a friend who was his assistant for several years, for the last three or four years before he died. And his house was like one of those eccentric people you read about, where the only way that you could get from one room to another was a very narrow passageway. All the rest of the room was just covered with all this amazing stuff that he had collected from one place to another, just sort of lying around. He seemed to know where everything was. And it was her job to go there and get it out, since he could hardly move around at that time. But, at any rate, you can see something about these particular boxes, especially the one at the bottom and the ones at the upper left, that has a kind of mysterious quality about it. It's that air of mystery that gives you the feeling like this really meant something to this guy. I mean, even if you don't understand it, there's a certain kind of feeling that you can get. The bottom one, particularly because of the color and the contrast of that blue color and the white feathers, and makes you feel that there's something real charged, an emotional charge that it has, at least for me anyway, just to experience it. I don't need to know specifically what he's talking about. In fact, it doesn't even matter if he's talking about something specifically for me to be able to get something out of it. It's another one of his. All of his stuff exists in boxes. You can make small boxes out of cardboard, and I can show you how that can be done. And we have paint. You can paint them. You may, in fact, have buy magazines around. We do have limited access to a copy machine, so you can actually do some Xeroxing. You can use your own childhood photograph that you can Xerox, reproduce, and use as a wallpaper kind of thing. You can even take your own toy, shove it down on a Xerox machine, and make some pictures of that as well. I mean, there are all kinds of ways you can make these things work. You can just go find pine needles and pine cones if you want. In fact, if somebody really wants to go out there and make a snow shrine, I see no reason why we can't all go out there and look at your snow shrine as well. So that's anything goes as far as I'm concerned with it. As long as it meets the criteria, I don't care. It's a kind of shrine to a television, which I think is kind of interesting with all that hay down at the bottom. And it's showing a very interesting kind of contrast there. I don't expect anyone to be able to do that. This one is actually called a cricket cage. Crickets are very endowed creatures in, I think it's Japan, is it not? They're good luck and a lot of other things attached to them. So oftentimes what people will do is they'll take live crickets and bring them in the house and put them in a little cage and feed them until they die. But this particular thing is sort of, it's called cricket cage, although in essence it's hard to tell. There's a kind of sandwich that exists inside with these soldiers around it, and inside that sandwich, underneath a layer of fake lettuce, is a plastic cricket. Because obviously there's some implications there. This particular thing is not exactly a shrine, but it's in the form of a shrine. So I thought you might get some ideas by looking at it. This is another sculpture. These are all basically found objects that you won't find around here, but this in fact is a little shrine. Inside that door that opens up is this small little area lit by its own strange light that has, it's all dark blue, with one white egg sitting in the middle of it. This one definitely has a kind of shrine-like quality around it. The thing that's important about looking at these pieces too is don't worry about specific narration. Don't worry about what the literal meaning of things are. Just get your own kind of experience with it. What happens when you see things placed in a particular kind of way, isolated in its own little environment, and placed and our attention focused as it does, all these objects start having meaning. Now often what happens when you see it is you don't understand the meaning and then you sort of get aggravated. One of the first things that happens, I think, when people start looking at art and they don't know much about it yet or haven't seen very much, is that as a kind of sense of, well, almost anger that comes out of frustration. Part of it is because, in a way, what's going on inside of you, you say, well, who does he think he is trying to show me this stuff? I mean, it's just garbage sitting there. What you're saying is, I feel stupid because I don't understand it, and I'm just not going to let him make a fool out of me. The best thing to do when you're confronting stuff like that is don't worry about it, because most of these guys didn't know what they were talking about anyway. Just sort of invent your own experience, what that might mean for you, being able to get yourself into it. When you look at each other's shrines, you're not going to always understand what someone's symbology is. But if you give yourself the opportunity to just experience it as if it were your own shrine, as if it were something that was more personal than that, you might actually make an important connection that will be off-center from what the person who made it meant, but maybe important kind of feedback. The small red groom sculpture that I thought was sort of like a shrine to Mom that I couldn't help but put in. It just made out of cardboard and painted. And although you'll be seeing more of my own work, I threw one of my pieces in too, because this particular piece is called Altar Dog, and it is essentially like a shrine. So that's really the last one that I had. I purposely do not want to show you other students' work for a very basic reason. My experience has been in a class like this that when you see what one person does, you think that's what I want you to do, and you'll start imitating it. So I don't want to show you what they did. I want you to come up with your own ideas. What that means then is you're a lot freer and a lot more anxious about it because you don't know what to do. The thing I want to intensify, I'll start going backwards in these guys, is don't worry about what you think we want. What I would rather you consider is how you can meet for yourself the criteria as it exists. We'll go through these one more time here, and then we'll start asking some questions. Kate, do you want to add anything?
No, I think it'll be good to restate the criteria, because
yeah.
Okay. I don't know.
I don't want to go get the mics. I think I'm going to add a little bit too when we're done reiterating some of this and maybe answering some questions, is I want to talk a little bit about visual language that may help a little bit too. Most of you have had language courses, the written language courses, since probably before you were in school, actually, from your parents. You learned about language, you learned about the spoken word and the written word, but no one taught you very much about visual language. That you were left up to your own to figure out. Probably the best teacher you had about visual language was your television set. So we'll talk a little bit about that in a minute. But let's reiterate what makes a shrine a shrine. Someone want to help me out on this one? Go back to your notes. What's the first thing you said? Okay, mystery. That a shrine should have a kind of sense of mystery about it. Let me elaborate that just a little bit. When we think back at our childhoods, I think a lot of us think back through a kind of limited memory. It's sort of funny how the older you get, the more of your childhood you tend to remember. I don't know if that's because as you get older, you generally have kids yourself, and that helps you remember your own childhood or something. But or maybe it's because now you're so close to your childhood and you're moving off into your adulthood more than that, you really don't want to look back, so you kind of resist it. But the mystery of your childhood is one that, I suppose the best way to describe it is looking back at the definition of symbolism. Because what it does is it tries to tell you that these things are greater than the sum of their parts. They're talking about that sense of mystery. They're talking about feelings. So I think the important part is to try and invest the object that you have with you, or the object that you may find or draw or invent or whatever, with that kind of feeling. Sometimes that's very difficult to do, especially since you haven't the skills yet to do that. But we'll talk about that in the workshop situation, how you can do that. But the first thing you have to do is identify the feeling as best you can. Sometimes a color is all it takes. Like that blue in that one piece really gave me a very specific feeling. Very simple. It doesn't have to be complex. In fact, simplicity may be a very excellent way of going about eliciting a particular kind of feeling. Okay, mystery. What else?
Isolation.
And we're not going to be able to exactly isolate these in corners, but that sense of isolation in encapsulated space, within that encapsulated space, I forgot who had mentioned it, it might have been Kathleen, I don't know, but a shrine has an environment of its own that's charged with that quality. And that's part of the fact that it is in a space that's isolated, it is encapsulated. A shrine isn't just a podium with an object on it. A shrine is a podium with an object on it with an environmentally described space. Sometimes it's an architectural niche in a church. Sometimes it might be a box like we've seen. Sometimes it might be carved out of a tree. I've seen some very beautiful kinds of shrines in the woods like that, where they're actually carved out of a tree or out of stone, as many Buddhist shrines are. But it needs to be in a limited environmental space. One of the interesting things about that is that when you're trying to express a very large concept, it is sometimes easier to do that by making it in a very small space and focusing your attention that much more specifically on something. It's an interesting dichotomy, but I think it works very well. That's probably why we have altars in churches in addition.
That concept, is that referring to like feeling?
Yeah,
feeling
the mystery. What else did we say about the shrine?
It has to be an emotional experience.
Okay, it's an emotional experience primarily. It's not an intellectual or an academic one. Although you can use those as methods of getting into your emotional place. Most men in our culture have a hard time getting into their feelings. Most women have an easier time getting into their feelings, although that is changing over time. So getting in to involve yourself with those feelings may create some difficulty for some of you. If it were my project, probably what I would do is I would do a lot of free writing. I would do a lot of getting away by myself. I meditate, so I would probably meditate for a while. I certainly would give myself the freedom to allow my creative energies to come out. That may be different for a lot of you, and maybe you don't even know how to do it for yourself, and this may be a good way of experimenting it, and you might want to come and talk to me individually about it. But for me, I let my creative energies work in my studio by distracting my conscious mind and allowing my unconscious mind to work. Basically what that means is I have my stereo and my television in my studio, and oftentimes if there's a movie on the tube, I'll just turn that on. I won't watch it, but I'll listen to it. And there's a whole part of me that just sort of goes away and allows this other thing to just come out without me judging it. That's the important part you're going to have, is as you're coming out with your ideas for your shrine, don't prejudge them. Don't instantly decide that that's good or that's not good. Just let them come out. Get as much of them out as you can. Plenty of time to edit. A lot of times you're going to have this great idea and we won't be able to do it here because you won't have the skill or we won't have the materials. That's fine. We can always find a way of moving that same idea around, finding a different symbol that you would like, that you can do, or that we can help you do. So keep all that in mind. Anything else about it? I think that covers mostly what we described.
Well, the how-to, you're going to give a session on building boxes.
Right.
We'll describe what art supplies we have brought, and that'll be coming up in the future. But meanwhile, what we've got is the baby pictures and the art objects, and we're going to be doing more with those tomorrow.
Right. We'll be doing some free writes about them tomorrow.
When we try to think of this, are we, how much of our childhood are we thinking? It's really easy to try to think of something and stick in something that's part of me now that wasn't part of me then.
That's a real good point, and it's real tough. Most of us, when you think about our childhood, are so close to it now that it's real hard to kind of separate them. Just do your best. The best way to do it for me is I kind of go back in time. And this is something that I think I would like to give you to do after lunch. It won't take you very long, but I want you all to do a free write after lunch on your earliest childhood memory. Some of you may only remember something that happened when you were 11. Some of you may go back to 2 or 3. Find your earliest childhood memory. Just do a 5-minute free write. What that will do is it'll help you kind of just get back into that state. You have photographs and toys that are also real good things to use to kind of remember. Where did I live? Let's see. When I was 5 years old, what was my environment like? That's another way of keying into what it was like. Who are my friends? Things like that. Christine, do you have a question? Does that help, Kai?
A little bit. When you're looking at your first memory, should that be something that you think yourself, or like we, whenever I try to think back, I always relate something that I realize it's because we have a picture of it or something, and then I think I remember it. So I'm not sure.
That's a good point. I've heard so many stories about me when I was a kid that I remember the stories rather than remembering the person.
It's hard to know. Yeah. Whose story, whose reality.
Do the best you can, and don't worry about it. I think it's going to be a real tough one to kind of separate that out right now. Question.
Is there a limit, like of how young we need, how young a time we were that you want us to focus on for the shrine?
I'd like you to get as young as you can. I would like it to be younger than 8 years old, if possible. I don't imagine it's going to get too much younger than 2, but somewhere in that range would be ideal. But you may not be able to do it. Some people may have a real feeling for themselves as an infant because of all the stories they've told that has become a part of their personal mythology now. If that's the case, go for it. Others may not really remember very much short of their very earliest adolescent experiences, in which case, whatever it is, it's got to be yours. What's most important to me is that it just is your own experience, not what you think Kate and I want, and not what you think you should do because of what everyone else is doing. So it's got to be honest. So, you know, whatever it is, it'll be okay, I'm sure.
Thank you.